Welcome to another episode of International Clearance. I'm Joe Walker, and I'm joined as always by Scully.
Hello. No, I left it a second. I was deciding if I was going to say hello or if they just take your word for it that I'm here.
Yeah. You'd pop up eventually. We were actually together this weekend watching the AFCON final.
Yes.
Which was partisan. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So we went to the No Signal watch party. Shout out to the gang who put on an amazing event, an amazing watch party. It was great fun. There was a live band like with drummers and trumpets. Mm. There was chaps, which is a really popular drink out in Nigeria. Suya was on offer, jollof, puff puff. It was all going off.
The puff puff was crazy. I had my first ever puff puff, Oreo puff puff. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you went in heavy. That is a crazy first puff puff to have.
Game changer.
It was quality. I cannot complain. But I was reporting Ivory Coast undercover. It was tense in that room. There was not a lot of Ivorian supporters vocally. Luckily, Joe, you were there.
Yeah, I mean, I was wearing an Ivorian shirt with Zahara on the back because I don't have a Nigeria shirt. All my Nigerian friends inside were a bit miffed by that.
In the afternoon, I put on a Nigeria shirt and then I took it off. Statement of hate. I even have two and I was like, nah.
But I was neutral in there though, despite
you
wearing that.
Neutral. You were neutral.
And I want to say it was a 5% Ivorian turnout.
Well, what I will say is there was a lot of East Africans in the building and they might not have been vocal, but every East African I asked, or even Ghanaian, in fact, for the West Africans, and the Congolese, in fact, but the Central African, none of us were supporting Nigeria, and that's all I'll say on that matter.
Yeah.
The celebrations and the end of the night were quite funny because obviously final whistle went.
Mass Ivory Exodus. Coast. Mass
yeah, Exodus. Ivory Coast won. By the way, storytell ending for Haller. I'm really happy for him. But yeah, mass exodus is the words.
We were opening on that, not just because we were watching it together, but naturally there's diaspora on duty. Between the two sides, Ivory Coast, the host, who won it, They didn't have any British-born, British-raised players in there. Zaha's a name that's come up already. We're not in the squad this year. Nigeria, however, heavily represented by such diaspora. So Ajayi, Olaena, Calvin Bassey, Alex Iwobi, Ademola Lookman all started for Nigeria. Aribo comes off the bench as well to try and rescue it. That's as far as they got. I mean, they've had a great tournament, some of them. I mean, Lookman especially, 3 goals, but some eye-catching stuff. Olaena missed a penalty in the semi-final, but had his teammates bail him out. That was quite funny, his kind of public social media reaction to that. A proper adventure they've had. They'll be still gutted right now that they didn't win it, but they'll go again. And I imagine most of those will be in the squad again next time. So
I feel bad for Iwobi, mention for him. They were really building up a lot of their players. Iwobi is somebody they actually really love for the national team. But obviously, as quick as they lift you up, people can tear you down. So when Nigeria didn't win at the final whistle, a lot of their players, including the diaspora ones, and especially Iwobi, who they've been lauding just 2 days before as the Innit Boys, which is a popular African phrase for, you know, English diaspora kids, where Innit Boys. But they were lauding them and talking about how great they are. And when they lost the match, they went onto Instagram and were commenting underneath all the pictures. So Iwobi went and had to take all of his pictures down and probably archived them and decided to, you know, do his best to quieten the noise, which is a shame because as a diaspora kid, obviously we talked to Bevis Mugabe and it was really important and pertinent how, like, as diaspora kids, you want to play for your home nation. But when you see things like this, it's like, oh, I'm going to get slated anyway. So it doesn't really matter what I do. Like, and it's kind of like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because when they lost, I saw loads of Nigerians and British diaspora Nigerians calling for Saka saying, why didn't you play? And it's like, so you don't play, you're going to get slated. You do play, you're going to get slated. And it's just tough, man. I feel for footballers.
Yeah, crazy one. But they'll go again. Let's go back to the club game. Which top of the table clash did you pick on the weekend, Scully? Because Saturday night, you had Real Madrid and Girona at the same time as Bayer Leverkusen and Bayern.
I was watching Bayer versus Bayern because obviously you know, Harry Kane, I need to see how he's getting on. Like, as we said many times on this show, I think he's going to smash that goal record. But this matchup proved that it might not be as simple as we thought it would be. They got trounced by Xabi Alonso's Leverkusen. This game was a 6-pointer. So Leverkusen are top of the table. They are unbeaten. If they beat them in this game, they would kill their unbeaten streak and then also go ahead in the league by 1 point. You would think they'd give it their all. It just didn't seem to connect for them. It's really looking like Leverkusen could go on and do this now. Nathan Teller looks like an absolute beast in the Bundesliga. He's getting on the end of all of these free balls, cutting inside, all of this. Just playing fantastically. I think he's going to be really important now. He's getting games for them. He got the assist for the second goal. Great work.
Yeah, only one team in that game looked like the best team in the country. It wasn't a close battle. It was so clear that it was Leverkusen. Kane was super quiet. He really might not win a trophy out there now. Eric Dier as well, he wasn't at fault for any of it necessarily. Like, he was starting in midfield, and after about an hour, they hooked Upamecano, centre-back, and put Dier back there, which plugs gap, but you're getting your ass handed to you by a much better team. And unless there's something big change, maybe managerial, or I don't know what that title race looks like, it's going one way.
I'm very conflicted. I hate that Bayern win the league nearly all the time. I think they've won it 11 times in a row. So it would be great for another team to win it. Who are you supporting in that title race?
Given the theme of the podcast, I suppose I would want to be happy for Harry Kane and Eric Dier and see that that works. Although equally, if it doesn't work out this season, he has to stay out there longer. It still works for us. The Teller story at Leverkusen and the fact that Leverkusen haven't won it in so long means, I guess, it's better for football if they win it. Teller involved in there as well. It's nice. It's nice to have somebody in there.
It'll be a great story. It'll be a great story to get a relegation with Southampton, to play in the Champions League and potentially winning a title as well within like 12 to 18 months. I would love that for Nathan Teller.
Yeah, and he may well be on his way to getting there. The other top of the table clash that we mentioned is over in Spain. Girona, surprise story of La Liga this season. The new pretenders at the top of La Liga. They had their hair firmly ruffled by Real Madrid. They went to the Bernabeu and got done 4-0. Jude Bellingham, 2 goals. It's now 16 for the season in the league. It's 20 for Real Madrid overall in 29 games. He's already in their all-time top 100 goal scorers list. We're never going to get pulled up on it. Let's do a live sweepstake right now. How many Real Madrid goals will Jude Bellingham end up with?
I think he stays there minimum another 3 seasons. So I'm going to put him at 71.
Okay, interesting. I can be a git and go higher or lower here just by one, but I'm going to be more adventurous than that. I'm going to say 99 goals.
How old is he again?
Jude Bellingham is 20 and he's not 21 till June.
Yeah, he's probably staying there 5 seasons.
Yeah, there's no motivation to go anywhere else. As long as they're riding high atop of their league, you know, the European ambitions are going to be like met by Real Madrid, let's be honest. So as long as they want him, he'll be all right. Jude Bellingham did go off injured in that game though. He's going to expect to miss the next 2-3 weeks. So it did come at a price, but I don't think it's going to affect necessarily the predictions that we've laid out. It's not that serious an injury. Still well on track for just a crazy, crazy inaugural season at Real Madrid. Elsewhere in the Eredivisie, we're back to Ajax. Jordan Henderson gets another 90 minutes. There was a lot of report, I don't know if you saw them, Scully, that Jordan Henderson was going to captain Ajax on his second game. And that drew a lot of criticism and response, and, you know, as anything Jordan Henderson is involved in does. That didn't actually happen, though, in the end. I think, so it's just hot air.
I don't know. I'm very much of the belief that news will come out from clubs and they will see the public reaction and then they'll change their mind. I'm not saying that definitely happened here, but it wouldn't surprise me if it happened here. Like, I do think Henderson was brought as a leadership figure and I do think they've been having a tumultuous time. I don't necessarily believe that means he was definitely brought to be a captain, but I caught, like, you can understand how they might be like, oh, should we try it? The thing is, you shouldn't try it on the second game. Like, he literally just got it.
I don't know, man. I, quite often when the teams are struggling, new signings are often thrown straight into the captain's armband. It's almost like a statement. So that, like, you know, it can happen. In this case, it didn't. We'll see later on in the season how that plays out. But yeah, Henderson played the full 90 anyway. They lost the weight here in vain. So, you know, the steady progress, it still has the odd hiccup. They're fifth. But more positive news out of that game, Chuba Akpom, who came up in last week's episode with Cam, talking about deadline day movements and transfers that did or didn't happen. Cam said he was happy that Akpom stayed in the face of links to the bottom half of the Premier League on loan. He came off the bench and scored because I think they were 3-1 down, Ajax. So he brought it closer, made it tight at the end. He's now scored 6 as a substitute for Ajax this season. That's an odd place to be. I mean, you're still helping the team, but Ajax start a guy up front called Brian Brobbey. He's scored 13 league goals in 19 games. So I think he's not going to, from any time soon, change that role from being brought on when Brobbey is tired or needs help. But if they're both scoring, that gives Ajax the best chance of doing what they need to do this season. But also, if something is to happen to Brian Brobbey, like an injury, let's say, there's going to be confidence that Akpom can come in and just hit the ground running and make the absence not too hard felt. So in the position that he's in, he's making the best of it, I think, Chuba Akpom. He's shown the desire to stay. He's going to stick around despite not being the first choice. And when they called upon him, he's getting goals now. So it's as good a situation as it is without kind of any other additional injuries or stuff factoring in the current situation. So hold tight, Chuba Akpom. You might get more opportunities, and it's all about, can you take it from there? We spoke a lot last week about Jesse Lingard, speculated a little bit more about why this might be happening, what could happen. That move has happened now. Jesse Lingard signed for FC Seoul in the K-League in South Korea. More details have emerged, and we're getting some answers. Some are more surprising than expected. Scully, I know there's more to it. There's caveats to it, but how surprised were you to learn that Jesse Lingard is on $17,000 a week?
I was shocked, I'm going to be honest. like we said last week, he's a prem proven player. He can obviously contribute to a lot of teams. I'm honestly still surprised that he didn't get enough prem offers. I can't quite understand it because, yeah, he's definitely worth a lot more. It's looking like there's more to it than just a basic salary though, but I'll let you get into that.
Yeah, so taking a lot of this info from The Athletic, who did a deep dive on this move and why it happened. Lingard did a press conference and there's some quotes in that as well, which I might get to. But long and short of it, I think any Premier League interest, based on what he said about FC Seoul, was flaky or temporary. Because one of the big factors he says about this FC Seoul deal, I'll quote him at the press conference. Lingard says, when they came into the equation, they showed a lot of commitment. They flew to Manchester to watch me train and came with a contract. There were multiple verbal offers, but FC Seoul showed how much they wanted me, and it was only right I repaid their faith in me. They offered a 3-year deal in writing where everybody else was being wishy-washy, and I think he needed that at the time. Other deals rejected him, by the way. Championship offers, which I don't think he fancied taking. 2 deals from Besiktas. I think the last one offered $55,000 a week. A Slovakian club, which wasn't named, also did it, and a bunch of MLS teams. Portland Timbers being the only one that was named. But by the sounds of it, salary cap limitations in MLS affected that too. And you might be hearing that listener thinking, well, they would still be able to offer him $17,000 a week. Like, what's going on here? Why did he turn down Besiktas $55,000 a week? And that is because the commercial opportunities, and certainly the potential commercial opportunities on the top of that basic salary, could be a big sweetener for him. So even upon signing already, there's since been a load of domestic commercial offers come in involving FC Seoul and Jesse Lingard. So there's already money coming in there that he wouldn't have got by perhaps just joining a Premier League side or Besiktas. He's also getting a percentage of merchandise sales. That's not shirt sales as well, but merchandise sales generally, which is an interesting mechanic to use, I think. But then I guess it makes sense. Lingard isn't Messi, but when Messi joins into Miami, the logistics change and where that's distributed changes, who wants that kit changes. Lingard going to FC Seoul sells extra shirts. In Korea, there's going to be people that like Man United or whatever, and they want to get Lingard on the back. But equally, there's people who are just enthusiasts of not niche kits, but just, yeah, unusual kits from around the world. You're going to start seeing Lingard shirts in classicfootballshirts.com. You're going to start seeing them in those kind of places. And if he's getting a cut on all of those, that's an interesting deal, particularly if it goes really well. There's no end to that ceiling if you're throwing in all these additional commercial incentives on top of it.
This is a bit like the football's versions of a rapper owning their masters and getting a cut of everything. You might go through the label, but you're still getting a good cut. It's very interesting.
It's him really backing himself that we're going to make some change happen here in the K-League, and hopefully the interest follows. If my performances are all right, then the interest follows. People like us are talking about it. You know, you're going to see some clips on Sky Sports News when the season starts over there. If he's doing well, if it goes quiet, the stories will go quiet. So it's almost as much as it on him to deliver and make it seem financially worthwhile to Seoul, who have probably stuck their neck out a little bit. And if it delivers, it could be an absolute masterstroke in terms of, you know, not to go too far, but, you know, you think about the mechanics of Beckham going to MLS. This is a smaller scale version of that, but one that could equally have ramifications and certainly financial reward for Lingard that has similar impact on the league over there.
He is the biggest non-career player there. In perspective, it seems that he's taken real star power there in terms of a foreign player on this team. So he could move the needle.
Seoul are six-time winners of the K-League. I think their last win, their league title win, was 2013. They finished 7th out of 12 last season, so mid-table side. I guess the remit is to win or achieve a lot, razzle-dazzle. We'll see if one player can make that change. He is a good player. We know that, as you say, he's a Premier League player. Let's see how he fares in the K-League. His first league fixture will possibly be on March 2nd, and we'll be ready and waiting to report on how he gets on out there. Their seasons in Korea is March till December. And don't you worry, we'll be relaying that information to you as well.
What are the odds on Southgate going out to catch a game?
Ooh, given what we said last week, how surprised we were, and he went because it was his Bezo, I don't think he's going to go out there at all. That's not a risky bet, that. But yeah, good luck, Jesse Lingard. Fingers crossed he gets on well. There's one more story before we get into our interview this week, Scully.
Yeah. Former Palace and Southampton player Jason Puncheon has a new role. Some of you may not have been aware, but he recently stepped into management in Cyprus, but he left his role at Pire 2014 in January, and he has started at AEZ Zakaal. I'm so sorry to the Cypriots that I am butchering these names. I hope you can forgive me, but Jason Puncheon is becoming a Cypriot legend.
Yeah, I didn't know that he was managing in the second tier of Cyprus this season. He left that job in January, as you say, but clearly in demand, clearly well thought of over there. And I guess, you know, so the latter end of his playing career, once he left Palace, he went to Cyprus after that, played for Paphos and then Famagusta, and of course it's Famagusta. So a Premier League player jumping straight to the Cypriot League, probably high profile relative to them, well thought of, and clearly likes the lifestyle out there. Otherwise, he wouldn't keep going there. But yeah, he's got this job with Zakaku. I can't really speak for how he got on at the other club to leave halfway through the season. The kind of mid-table mediocrity, but looking at how the season's going out there. Well, we spoke about the league system with Chris Dixon when he played out there in the first season. Breaks in half, a bit like the Scottish Pyramid. And I guess, look, Zakaku have won 2 games in 23. That's honking form. And just because terrible. There are two teams below you currently in the table doing worse than you, you can't ride on that. When you can't buy a win, you've got to change something up, because ultimately you're going to have to fight out amongst each other. They need to make sure they survive that. And Jason Puncheon, of all people, has been entrusted to do that. We're looking at the team. There is one British contingent there alongside him. Alistair Reynolds, who is born in Scotland, but moved to Cyprus age 9. So probably a very pasty, sunburnt Cypriot. now, Scully, he's named after a Scottish footballer. Alistair Reynolds, who do you think Alistair is named after?
Oh, you're going to give me some help. You've got to give me some help here. I can't be. No way. Nah.
Yes.
What, the commentator?
So Ali McQuist, yeah.
No way.
Alistair as in Ali. McQuist obviously did all right for Scotland, but is a Rangers legend, so.
McQuist was a fantastic player, but very much before my time.
I
know him as an iconic commentator. So yeah, I know that he obviously played, but to me, he is one of the voices of football.
He is. He's probably my favourite co-commentator out there. Mm-hmm. So, very interesting. That's just a little footnote onto that.
I'm interested to see how Punchin does. Would you take him at Palace next season?
I mean, if he wins every game out here, we'll see how we get on. The other thing to factor in with this, which I guess I'll try and keep an eye on it, is who the backroom staff are. It'd be interesting to see whether he goes full, like, all right, I'm mixing it up with a local backroom staff, or whether he's like, anyone that wants to come out here, back, bring the Pulis era Palace back, Balazi assistant manager, player coach.
Imagine that.
Well, fingers crossed we don't have to, and it's a very real thing. Balazi a free agent, of course, right now.
Punches cheeky pack, that's what they'll call him.
Yeah, an interesting little story there. Right, let's get into our guests. Keener supporters of this podcast, I would say, may know this person because his professional football career has been stuff of dreams, and it's stuff we want to read about, and he has written about it. Seth Birkett, I'm not going to put you in a spot here, Scully. We did record this after season one finished. It was done like maybe a month after we wrapped that season up. Full intention for it to come out maybe like 3-4 months later. I had to bring it back for this series because the story is still amazing. I think forever will be one of the most intriguing guests that we've had and stories that we've had in terms of the overseas odyssey.
I do remember reading that book, and at first, obviously, it's almost
still like, got that book, I think. I was trying to look for it the other day.
Oh, sorry. I'll give that back. I've actually been recommending it to loads of people, like a lot of people. It's definitely helped me build an appreciation for why this podcast exists. Like the stories you have to tell, and like the idea of football just being this language. I just think it's amazing. So big up, Seth, man. Great guest as well.
Yeah. And it's just two nations we haven't discussed on here as a podcast yet. He has played professionally in both Brazil and Sri Lanka. Paid to play football in Brazil and Sri Lanka. It's an unbelievable story, and let's not waste any more time. It's a long interview because it justifies it. Here is our interview with Seth Birkett. Seth Birkett, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks very much, John. Good, thanks. How are you?
All good. I must say, I'm fascinated by the story, and because we could cover so much here, and we'll get into the books, but Peterborough United, in your mid-teens, you get released, and you play for Stamford. Are we talking sixth, seventh tier there?
Eighth level.
It's, okay.
Is it North Premier League Division, South East, whatever it is. So, step four, I think.
Okay.
In the pyramid.
Essentially, you were playing there to supplement whatever ambitions you had to go through your A-levels and then go on to university. You want to go full-time.
Yeah, I think when you get released, obviously, from an academy, you do have to assess how likely it is you're going to be a footballer. And for me, university seemed like the obvious path, along with non-league football. Still, obviously, really wanted to become a professional footballer. But I realised that was going to be quite tough in England. And I'd actually been looking abroad. I sent hundreds and hundreds of emails to clubs in Sweden, Estonia, like all these places around Europe, just asking for a trial, and got nothing back. So I kind of thought playing abroad was kind of gone for me as well. There, I didn't know what else to do.
Can I ask quickly, what age were you when you got released?
So many different ages. Because I was released by Peter when I was 10, and signed for Northampton instead. Then they released me when I was 13, and then I re-signed for Peterborough, but got released under 16s again. So actually got quite used to being released.
Right. How do you keep the fire alive?
Yeah, I think that failing and being released so early on, like I was 10, to me, football was my world. And I was absolutely devastated when Peterborough said, we don't think you're good enough to play for us anymore. And I just remember like crying. But I think kind of like having that failure so early on and then realising that, oh, actually I can overcome this and I can use this. And most of all, really, it was really to prove them wrong, because you take it personally. You think it's a coach and the coach doesn't like you. And you just think, right, I'm going to prove that coach wrong. Back at that age, you don't realise that, you know, this coach, they don't want to release players, but they kind of have to, because they have to maintain the standard. But I think, yeah, kind of taking that personally and wanting to prove those coaches wrong really helped me long term to try and progress and do well in football. And I do remember when I was out in Brazil and obviously got the contract, I remember messaging that the very first coach that released me and saying, oh, just, you know, here I am now. And it felt so good to me, even after those years.
Fair play. That journey from Stamford to Brazil is a series of very kind of right place, right time, or that a random person that all kind of sets it all in motion. Anderson Silva, who the banner headline would be the agent for Danielson's move to Arsenal. He was what, just kind of in the area watching you guys play?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. It's just such a series of fortunate events that really kind of helped me to get there. Anderson Silva was a guy who came over from Brazil with aspirations of playing professional football. For some reason, ended up in Stamford working in an ASK. No one really knows where Stamford is, so that was random enough. But he was after realising he probably wasn't going to play professional here, he acted as an agent. He was bringing lots of players over from Brazil to England, and he actually put a couple of them in the team at Stamford. And as part of that, he started coming along to watch our games for the under-18s, because at this time I was kind of in and around the first team, but, you know, not really playing much. I was like getting 20 minutes here and there as 17-year-old. But no one really knew who was an under team. There's kind of rumours that, oh, this guy's an agent. Oh, he's a big deal. He's coming to watch us to take us somewhere. But no one really knew exactly what he was. And then a few months into him watching our games, he said, look, guys, I've got this really exciting opportunity for you. There's a tournament happening in Brazil. It's an under-18 tournament. Would you like to take part in it? And for us, like, we were absolutely jumped to the chance. We didn't really know any of the details. But it turned out that the Brazilians were so keen to have us over there that they're going to subsidise our visit. So all we needed to do was raise £500 for the flights, and they'd cover all the accommodation, all the cost of food and everything. So
even just going anywhere abroad at that point to play in a tournament would be fun. But Brazil, it obviously has this magical context and extra feeling when it comes to football. What were your early experiences then? How much did they match up with what you were expecting upon landing and going to the accommodation and stuff?
Well, I mean, that's exactly it. Like, growing up for me was all about Ronaldo, Roberto Carlos. I think it's kind of that sweet spot where Nike really picked up in Brazil as well and started pushing Brazil and advertising. So, like, I always had this massive affection for Brazil. And we're all so keen, because we see Brazil as a spiritual home of football. So we're all so keen to go to Brazil, because we thought, even thinking, oh, we might play a professional team here in this tournament. And it turned out that our first game was against Brazil national team, who had been joining the same group as. We were used to playing at Arnsbury Robes under-18s, you know. And Brazil had Coutinho playing for them. So, yeah, we got hammered 8-0. Coutinho scored a hat-trick and there were 8,000 people in the stadium kind of laughing at us. But it was just mad. And it kind of worked out well for me, because I was technically too old to play in the tournament. So I didn't play in that first game. But after that hammering, they just said, well, you know, what's the worst that's going to happen? We're not going to qualify here. But because I was too old, there was about five of us who were too old, and we went and trained for this local team called Vitória. Now, at the time, they were kind of a mid-table, top-division team, trained in their under-18 team. And a week into that training, which was great, like, absolutely loved it, everything with the ball, lots of size one balls being used, technical drills. And, yeah, so about a week into that, the coach said to me, like, look, if you've been training well with us, and actually our left-back's been called up to the Brazil under-19 squads. He's gonna play for them. We've got a friendly, and we need a new left-back. Do you fancy it? And so I thought, wow, this is incredible.
Here we go.
Yeah, but then the game was played at midday, and all our games in tournament that far had been played in the evening.
Right.
And that was hard enough, because it's so humid out there. And as a left-back, you know, expected to bomb off.
A left-back in Brazil as well, not a sort of unadventurous full-back position or at Stamford. I imagine you're really having to go up and down. You're probably doing the most distance covered.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at Stamford, to be fair, like, our coach, like, great coach under-18s, like, very attack-minded, liked his full-backs to bomb up and down. But the first team manager was not not that at all. My job for the first team was to get the ball, pass it to the winger and stay in defence.
Right.
And so though I wanted to be a Brazilian fullback, when I played that game midday, I thought, I'm just going to have to play first team manager at Stamford here because I cannot bum up and down this wing at midday in this heat, this humidity. Because the thing with Vitória is it's in the northeast of Brazil. And so even the guys from São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, find it almost unbearable with the heat. It gets so, so hot in the day. So I really played a safe game. But there was a guy watching who Anson had got to help out of our team called Emerson. And he said, well, Seth, I've got a team in Brazil. I'm going to be running next season and I'd love you to come and join us. So for me, that was just, yeah.
And this has all happened. What's the timeline here from you landing in Brazil to... I've sat and seen us get walloped by a Brazil youth team. Then you've played in this friendly and now you're being offered place at a team. Is this a week, 2 weeks?
The whole tour is about 12 days. So it must have been about a week in when this friendly happens. I mean, this is just after finishing my A-levels as well. So it's kind of really surreal.
At that age, at that time, I think we're all similar ages, Seth, is that A-level period, you can kind of go, I can defer university. I can always come back to that.
Yeah.
If I want to try something new out right now, I'm quite easy to do that. Was that the case with yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, I hadn't got into my first choice university anyway. So I was planning to take a year to reapply anyway. And I did, again, really want to push playing football abroad. When I was in year 11, I think I sent out all those emails. I trained with a team in Sweden, just I've got relatives out there. And then Anson actually sorted me out a trial with a team called Estrela Amadora, who... You might remember Bebe, the Manchester United. He was playing there at the time in the first team. So me and two other lads went out there a few months before actually going to Brazil. And that was a great experience. It was really interesting as well because they were a top division team at the time. I think they've been relegated a couple of times since then. But it was just...
Yeah.
We turned this AstroTurf pitch next to the stadium and they could only afford to turn the lights on half the pitch.
oh, wow.
As a left back playing on the far side from those floodlights, it was quite challenging as well.
Yeah. Obviously, playing against the Brazilian youth side, they're going to be a class above, or you're going to see the difference in class. In that friendly you played, obviously you're exhausted and stuff, but in terms of the quality, did you feel like, okay, I can handle myself at this level? It was just a case of fitness needing to come up or getting used to the climate.
Yeah, I didn't think I looked too out of place, to be honest. I thought I did an okay job. And actually, I think technically Brazilians, you always think that they're incredible and they are incredibly skillful. But a lot of the technical exercises I was doing at Vitória, I was thinking, actually, I'm fitting quite well here. And I'm one of the better ones, if anything. I think the thing which really differentiates them is that they can then do that in a game and they've got these just crazy skills they can drop from nowhere and they're very spontaneous. But I thought as well, probably being a defender did work in my favour in that technically they're incredible, tactically maybe less so. So I thought that having that edge on some of them could help me. Okay. But I mean, I didn't have any kind of belief that I was going to, you know, go ahead and have a top career in the top Brazilian league because I did see that, look, I'm in the under-18s here and these guys are just, they are brilliant footballers and so few of them actually go on to be top, top footballers. So
yeah.
It was a reality check, but I thought, let's just see where this goes.
Yeah. And so you have to leave everyone goes back to Stamford and you wave them off. How are they with that? Because, I got the impression from... I probably haven't even mentioned yet. You've written a book about each of your spells abroad. We'll get to the other one. But
yeah.
The first book is The Boy in Brazil, Living, Loving and Learning in a Land of Football. And there's a part in it, and you say it's almost like your teammates at Stamford were not, if they were jealous, they definitely weren't hiding it. They were almost kind of like relieved that they were going back home because of just the food and et cetera.
That's exactly it. Because to be honest, I think I got asked to go out there, but I think if one or two of the others had pushed it, they could also come out here with me.
Right.
But even on that 12-day tour, quite a few of them were quite homesick and they couldn't wait to get home. And it is, you know, playing abroad, I'm sure you guys know, you know, it is a tough to adapt. You're really out of your comfort zone. Things are just so different to what you're used to. And so I think they're like, yeah, all the best, Seth. And but I think they're pleased for me. There was a couple of months between getting back from Brazil and then going back out there. And in those couple of months, I was never actually sure it was going to happen. Our experience in Brazil was that organisation wasn't really a strength. There was a game we played towards the end, a friendly against a team called Bahia, and it was scheduled for a 12 o'clock kickoff as well. And we got there at 11, no one was there, you know, the gates were all locked, and the team didn't turn up until 2 o'clock, and there was no ref, and it kicked off about 3 o'clock. And I mean, that was kind of their experience of Brazil, and they were thinking, you know, how can people live like this?
Right.
So that was another reason why they weren't that jealous of me, but also... For those 2 months, I was kind of in a bit of a purgatory where I wasn't sure if it was ever going to happen because I'd had this verbal you know, saying, come play for my team. But there wasn't a written agreement. There wasn't a contract. I didn't actually see a contract until about a week into going to going back to Brazil the second time. So it was all just so uncertain.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, obviously you sound like you're in purgatory for a bit, but you do eventually land. But then even then, I remember you get to Brazil and it doesn't even feel like, do they know I'm here?
No, yes, I was still in purgatory there where I landed in Cuiabá, which is the nearest airport. It's an 8-hour drive to Sorriso. And I didn't have a clue what's happening next. I'd forgotten to do all that in the emails. And there was this guy, like, he was wearing kind of a football polo shirt. I approached him and I said, oh, Sorriso. He said, yes, are you Michelle? I said, no, I'm Seth. He said, no, I'm here for Michelle. And it turned out this guy was a club chairman, but he'd been sent to pick up a Portuguese goalkeeper and he didn't know anything about an English left back.
Right.
That I only found out afterwards because I just had to guess that this was the right guy. And so I kind of looked...
Could you imagine if he hadn't been there to pick up the Portuguese goalkeeper?
I was in this 8-hour drive thinking, like, is this the right guy the whole time? Because he didn't speak English. Michelle didn't speak English. I'd tried to learn Portuguese, but struggled. So I couldn't really speak to them. So I just sat in this car for 8 hours, just being a bit like anxious about
what's going on.
Yeah. Oh,
my goodness. Because as you say there, we're not talking tourist hotspots of Brazil here where you're going to. So language, as widespread as English is, was that immediately a bit of an issue?
Absolutely. I was quite surprised. I think of English as a global language, and I did think that, you know, several of the team would speak English, but there's only one guy and he didn't live with us. I only saw him at training, so it was quite tough to adapt. But actually, I'd had months of trying to learn Portuguese out of books and got nowhere. But, you know, a month in that environment where Portuguese is all around you, do pick it up quite quickly and you get the gist of things. And I mean, also, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, football's a global language, so that's easy. And I mean, most of all, swearing is a global language, so that's how we bonded initially. Is they just get me to stand up in the middle of the room and say swear words in Portuguese.
Another thing which I thought was fascinating, which I guess is kind of reflected in the careers of some of the Brazilian stars that we know who are at the top level, they don't really necessarily care about age if they'll throw 13, 14 year olds in. So this setup that you were in, the age range really varied, didn't it?
Yeah, I was really surprised about that. And we all lived together as well. So there were, I think, 30 of us in this three bedroom converted garage that they had as a house. Mm-hmm. And within those 30 people, there were, like I say, 13 year olds in an under 18 team. And these 13 year olds had given up everything. They didn't go to school and they just trained every day. We trained twice a day, 6 days a week. And that was a real eye-opener to me as well, to see how seriously Brazilians took football and how they just give up absolutely everything to try and make it. And the standard of them was frightening, to be honest. It taught me a lot about life. I mean, as an 18-year-old kid going out there and not really ever suffering hardship and having, you know, friends from all walks of life to an extent, but playing on the same team as guys in favelas who, you know, they can't go outside at night because every side of their house is drug dealers and they shoot. And guys saying that, you know, when police come into the favelas, you just have to hit the floor and hope that their bullets don't hit you. Like, hearing stuff like that and seeing what football means to those guys is just crazy. There's a guy who played on our team called Fernando, who I always tell his story because it just really got me, where we were paid 300 real a month, which is about £120. So it wasn't much, but to Fernando, it was everything. And for this stay in Brazil, he brought everything he owned in the world in a backpack. So he had a vest, pair of shorts, pair of flip-flops, toothbrush and a pair of football boots. That's all he had. And then each month he'd send back almost all that money to the favelas. And this guy was just so happy of life. And you're like, you play on the same team as guys like that. And you just think, you know, what's important in life. And you just learn to see it in a different light and see everything positively. And so, yeah, we had one goal, and that was all of us wanted to be professional footballers. But it was just so beneficial to me for thinking about positively about football, I suppose.
Yeah. I want people to go and check out these books. So I don't want to pick into every part of it. But obviously, there's some things that did take getting used to. Obviously, we're talking about the numbers involved and the amount of possessions, and you said a converted garage. The facilities in terms of things like hygiene and stuff are not the greatest. I've read about, you know, the toilet brush was on the kitchen table when you arrived and you're like, okay, what's that about? But the soap story, can you tell the soap story, please?
Oh, wow. So this is when the one guy that spoke English really came in handy for me. So I went to Brazil, like, as a typical teenager, like quite spotty, bit of acne. And a week into the stay, my acne was just mad. Like, there were spots everywhere. I used to wake up in the morning. So we'd get woken up at 7:45 in the morning and have to go into the washroom to get our kit for the day. And I'd wake up and I'd go to the washroom and all my team would say, "Oh, monster, monster, Shrek," because my face was so bad.
Shrek.
I don't know what. And after one of the training sessions we had, we came back to the house to shower, and Iago, the one guy that spoke English, he came with us. And in terms of washing your clothes, there's not really many places to do that. So I was just in the shower as you are and went to get the soap that was on the shower on the little tray. And Iago said, "Oh, my friend, what are you doing? Don't do this." And I was like, "Oh, why? Like, I've got to use soap." And he said, "Oh, no, this soap, how can I say in English? The guys, they use it to wash their arseholes." And so using it obviously there, but also on our pants, because we obviously train so much, there was a weekly wash, but people didn't have enough pants to do that. So what they'd do is the soap, they just rub it on their pants like that.
Yeah.
And put it back, and that's the soap I've been using to clean my face. So
suddenly your acne goes away mysteriously.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it subside?
Well, Fernando gave me a tip. I didn't use it, but Fernando said, "Oh, in Brazil, this is what we do with when we have acne. We, how can I say, we have a little tug, and then we use the liquid on our face."
Wow. Okay.
I said, "Fernando, you can keep that for me." Yeah. For me, no.
And that as well. I feel like British people, we are quite conservative, maybe a little bit repressed and inward when it comes to sexuality and you know, inhibitions like that. Whereas very clearly, whether it's talking about masturbating like that, whether it's masturbating in front of you, and whether it's just having sex in that garage and stuff in particular, they seem to be, culturally, it was just miles away from that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was exactly like you described there when I came to Brazil. And just, I guess, just being in a house with these guys with lots of testosterone there. And also these guys who have spent a lot of their formative years as teenagers growing up like that in a house full of boys. There's quite a lot of experimentation. There's a lot of openness. You know, I'd go to shower after trade session, just see guys openly masturbating in the showers. And people didn't think twice about that. And for me, that was quite...
Does that ever become normalised, or are you always forever just going, this is weird?
Yeah, I was forever going, this is weird. Pretty much every night my bunk bed started rocking when, you know, a guy would just see to himself. It was a bit grim, to be fair.
you never went, "Oh, when in Rome," nothing like that, no.
You know, that is a funny way of the question I was asked. It does is an insight into how living in other cultures shapes you. So although, you know, I'm assuming you don't go on lads' holidays and have a tug like while you're in the bed opposite, but do you think it has changed your approach in general to just the world about you? Like, do you feel like you could dance a bit better? I know Brazilians love to dance. Like, what do you feel like you picked up and learned, kind of like by osmosis?
I mean, my dancing's still stiff, so nothing there. They tried to teach me to samba, but that was no good. I think that, yeah, the main thing was probably with Fernando, where I just saw how he took life and how he had so little in life but just made so much of it. And I think that was really important for my mentality of learning to see everything positively. And if there's a negative, like, "Oh, you know, I've not played today," then you try and see that in positive, like, okay, well, maybe if I would have played, I'd have got injured. So I think that was important. I think everything... You know, Brazilians are just such a joyful, it's infectious. And I think that happiness and learning to be happy in any situation was something I really picked up by osmosis and was probably the main thing I took away from that. I think also as an 18-year-old playing abroad, you're going to learn a lot about life and about being independent, about fending for yourself. So those are probably the main takeaways I had.
You have this kind of surreal thing going on in the background where obviously you have this very formative and eye-opening experience day to day. But when it comes to games, I don't know whether it's off the back of the noise around when you guys first arrived on tour, but you're making some noise of the fact that, "Oh my gosh, there's this Englishman playing over here in this part of the country," or Brazil full stop, and there's TV interviews of you and stuff like that. How, like, what was that like?
That was surreal as well, because the reality was that I was probably fourth choice left back for the under 18 team. So I was like way away from being the best player in the team, but I was getting the most media coverage. And on my first full day in Brazil, I was taken to this TV studio where I had an interpreter with me, and they asked me loads of questions on live TV. And it was just mad. And I think there was such a story because it wasn't only an Englishman in Brazil, but it was an Englishman in such a random part of Brazil. Mm. So he's in Mato Grosso, which is very much farm country. And the fact that this Englishman had gone to this random part in Brazil really struck a chord, I think. And at first it was many local news, but soon, as we got closer to this competition called the Copa Sao Paulo, which is what we're training for, it soon became national news, and I had to get used to just turning on the TV and seeing my face on TV, which was absolutely mad. I think the craziest one was when we went to Sao Paulo for the tournament, and I was in a room with two other lads, and I was sleeping. It was like the rest before a game, and this camera crew came in, and they just started filming me sleeping. And then later that evening, I saw myself sleeping on national TV. It was just...
How did you feel after that? Because that is a gross invasion of privacy, I must say. Like, that's the type of thing that I have nightmares about.
I think the good thing was that I was in Brazil. Like, none of my mates were seeing that. So because of that, it didn't really matter to me. And I think also, again, the fact of age, like if that had happened when the second time I went abroad, I wouldn't have liked that. And I've had words with people saying that this isn't on. But because I was 18, you just kind of think, great, I'm going to be on TV. And it was still really exciting back then to just have people talking about me, because I think probably in the back of my mind, you're still like, oh, I'm still the kid that got released by Peterborough. So it's amazing people are talking about me nationally because of football.
You mentioned there that you effectively fourth choice left back there, but you're getting all this coverage. Do you think that that might have been in a part of the club's decision to offer you pro terms or keep you on, was that it probably reflected really well on them that you were playing there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the club was ranked, I think there's 800 professional clubs in Brazil, and Cerezo was ranked about 350th, so very minor club. And yeah, I was, but in terms of ability, I don't think I was the worst player in the team, but I was quite a long way from being the best player. But because of all that media attention, I did get offered a professional contract. The chairman told me that he sacked the manager because the manager didn't actually play me in the Copa Sao Paulo. He preferred other left-backs. And he said, oh, I've sacked the manager. He was going to be the first team manager, but I didn't like he didn't play you. So he sacked and you've got a professional contract.
Wow. Yeah.
But I mean, didn't really stick out too much under 18 training, but then you go and play the senior team and like, wow, I was getting nutmegged for fun. I was in the middle of the Rondo circle for just so long. But a great experience.
So I know with Brazil, it's split into, you get kind of your domestic national league for the biggest, however many teams. But as you say, there's all these other professional clubs and they tend to have all these cups the other half of the year and all the state championships and stuff like that. So that was more what your focus was on.
Yeah, I still can't really get my head around the system, to be honest. The Copa Sao Paulo was a national youth competition. It's the equivalent of the FA Youth Cup, but it's condensed into 1 month. And that's a really famous competition because it's typically where your new big talents get discovered. So the year that I played in, Lucas Moura was a top scorer in the Copa Sao Paulo. With the pro team, yeah, you've got the national leagues, which I think play for 9 to 10 months of the year. Then you've got state leagues. So Corinthians, you know, will play in their state league when they're not playing the national league. So Brazilian teams essentially play for 12 months of the year. The team that I was playing for, so in the Copa Mato Grossense, which was the state that my team was in, there were, I think, only two or three teams in the national league system. The rest were all solely state system.
Right.
So I was there to play in the state league. But then they have state cups throughout the rest of the year, these teams, to kind of make sure they still play. But those state cups aren't always on at the same time. So you essentially get just new team for every single state league, a new team for every single state cup, because the players go from team to team, finding new contracts. So as fans, you can never get used to having the same player play for you, really.
Okay. We jumped a bit, but you've gone, I guess the early part of what we've been speaking about was, as you know, in their under 18s, that jump to pro then, in terms of also first team, senior team.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit more about that period?
Yeah. So that was a real kind of eye opener, just at the standard again. There were six of us from the under 18 team who were given deals with the first team. We got to move out of our horrible accommodation, which was a converted garage, and got put into a hotel, which was like a load of little chalets. So we had a 2-person chalet between the six of us youth team. So again, it was literally single mattresses just all on the floor, no space. But it was much nicer. We had a pool table and a bit more space around the complex. And the players in the first team were great. I mean, our captain was a guy called Capone, and he won the UEFA Super Cup back in the year where they beat, was it Arsenal they beat in the final of the UEFA Cup? And then they went on to play Real Madrid in the Super Cup and beat them.
Okay.
So he'd obviously played loads of times for Galatasaray. Just crazy experience. By the time he was with us, he was 38, he was overweight, he smoked about 40 a day, but still an incredible footballer. So we had guys like him, we had another guy called Alemão, who played in the same youth team as Kaká, and played a lot of games in the top league of the Brazilian National League. And we had guys who played Brazil's under 21 team, and guys who played in Germany, Switzerland. So it was great to learn from them. They welcomed me totally, like it was, yeah, amazing. They loved having an English player on their team. They'd always laugh and joke with me. But I mean, in terms of their ability, they were just fantastic. And it was a real great chance to learn from them.
I was going to say, how did playing with players of that ability grow you as a player? I mean, you went there to be a pro, right? But do you feel like you still had a lot of growing as a player to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, change my perceptions in football. I mean, Rondos is a great example. Like, I had that perception from playing in England that there's nothing better in a Rondo than to split the defenders and like get the ball over to the other side of the circle. Mm-hmm. And they taught me, I said, no, Seth, what you have to do is you have to play it short and suck the pressure in. And they're all about sucking the defenders in and then embracing that pressure from the defenders and then like going for the nutmeg. Mm. And though the nutmeg wasn't like kind of what I learned there, but I learned to be more comfortable under pressure and to not actually worry about having opponents, because that meant that if they're putting them under pressure, there's more space elsewhere to exploit. So that technical side of the game taught me quite a lot. It was also quite interesting to see tactically how they set up. I felt that tactically I was probably better level than there. I thought the tactics weren't that developed, but they played quite similar to how Bielsa plays now, I guess, in a quite man-to-man system, which took me a bit of time to get used to. But it was great to be exposed to such a different tactical system. So it meant that as a left-back with the first team, they expected me to literally follow my player anywhere they went. So very little of my time was actually spent at left-back, and it meant that your centre-back would pop up at centre-forward and players just kind of went everywhere. And seeing that more fluid style of the game was great. Again, it taught me a different way of playing and a different appreciation of the sport, I'd say.
So you're learning, you're having a great time. While this is all happening, are you getting homesick at any point?
Yeah, absolutely. In the first team, I started to get quite homesick because with the under-18s, I was fourth choice left-back, but I was actually getting game time. I was getting involved in the games. At those games, I'd have loads of people come in the stands and they'd shout, "Oh, Seth, I love your sister. Let me marry your sister." Oh, they literally just used to abuse me, all these guys, the whole game. But it was great laugh, and like they did it because they liked me.
How did they know you had a sister?
One of them had Facebook.
That'll do it.
It's so funny. Like, you can go anywhere in the world, but some things never change.
Yeah, exactly. So as soon as they found this out, they didn't stop about all this. But with the senior team, it was just harder because there were 33 people in the squad and there was no reserve team. So even in training, I wasn't getting a game. Training would be your first 11, be your second 11, which then left 11 people on the sidelines. And the youth teamers, we were all literally just told to do pickups on the sidelines. With the youth team, when we'd been training, it was a lot of ball work, it's a lot of technical work. With the first team, I was surprised it was a lot of physical work. There wasn't much ball work at all. It would be 40-minute runs followed by a training game, which I wasn't involved in. And there are a few times where I didn't play at all in the game and I did any of the youth teams, and we just had to go and stand and be walls for practice at free kicks at the end. So I think when that was going on, I started to get a bit homesick. I thought there's no chance of me. I played in some friendlies, but there's no chance of me playing in the actual league. And in the end, none of the youth teams played in the league.
That's a shame. So as you feel it's starting to, maybe you're not going to get your breakthrough or chance and opportunity here, despite, as you said, they changed the manager. What happened after that? What was their drastic difference?
Yeah, it was all weird, actually, how it ended up, because I was told I had a two-year contract and I'd signed what I thought was a contract. And then there was about 2 weeks left of the season for the first team. So already I was kind of thinking, right, am I staying in Brazil? Because Anderson was telling me. So actually Anderson, to complicate matters further, when they sacked Emerson, the coach, Anderson advised me not to sign for Soriso because he didn't know anyone there anymore.
Right.
But because I was so desperate to sign a pro contract, I went ahead and did it. So Anderson kind of said, oh, there's a club called Taboão do Ceará in Sao Paulo. They'd be interested in you. So I didn't know if I was staying in Brazil or what. And about 2 weeks before the end of the season, the chairman came to me and said, oh, Seth, you have a problem. And I thought, well, okay. I wasn't sure how much to trust him because he didn't really speak English and he tended to get his words confused. So, like, often problem and congratulations, he used the wrong way around.
Right.
But it turned out that they hadn't actually renewed my visa or given me a work permit. So that meant that the 3 months that I had as a tourist were up, and they had been up for a couple of weeks. So technically I was an illegal immigrant. And he said, you have to fly to Paraguay and fly back to Brazil to get a new tourist visa. I said, well, what about a work permit? I signed a 2-year contract with you. Hmm. He said, no problem. You just fly back and fly here. And I think that was the moment where I just lost all trust, because I've been told so many times I had a 2-year contract. I've been told so many times there were no problems. I'd play in the next season. That it just, it was kind of the final straw. And so I said, look, I'm just going to fly back to England now. I kind of knew as well that I'm not going to have a career in Brazil. If I do sign another year contract, I'm still quite a bit off the level I probably need to be to play for the first team, at least regularly. So, that was kind of a decision made for me to come back to England.
Right.
I mean, I'm glad you got out of there because I'm pretty sure messing about with those visas and flying to Paraguay is what got Ronaldinho locked up. Even though it looked like he was having a splendid time in prison, you know, winning eating cakes and barbecuing pig. But yeah, that's how he got there. So,
well, that's actually what happened when I went to fly back. Is I checked into the flight and then went to go on board, and when I scanned my passport, it kind of picked something up and they said, "Wait there, sir." And two police officers came and they took me into this kind of underground police station, and they sat me down. It was almost like an interrogation. They had people behind them with machine guns watching me, and they're saying, like, why are you here? Why didn't you, you know, why are you an illegal immigrant? And I was so scared. I thought I was going to go to prison then. And I just like started blabbering and saying that I thought I had a 2-year contract. I'm really sorry I overstayed. It wasn't my intention. Please just let me off. And thankfully they took pity on me. They said to me, you know, this could be quite bad for you, but we're going to be generous and you can just have a fine. Until you pay that fine, you're not allowed back in the country. So that's how it kind of got left at.
Is that outstanding still? That's
still outstanding, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. I understand.
You're not going for some time soon.
I mean, the fine's like nothing. It's about 50 quid.
Next time you want to go back, it's not a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a micro version of your time in Brazil with Sorriso. As I said, the book out now. It's a lot more comprehensive. The Boy in Brazil. There's also another book that you've put out, which is about your second spell abroad, which is in another country you've not spoken about, Scully, which is Sri Lanka. So obviously in between, you've come back to England. Well, you've gone to write that book that comes out in around 2014, I believe, ahead of their World Cup. You get more involved with futsal, which is something that's a real passion of yours, I guess, as well, really helpfully influenced by your time in Brazil. Where are you in your life as this Sri Lankan opportunity comes?
Yeah, so when I got back from Brazil, I initially still really wanted to be a pro. I went to Loughborough Uni, but I was still speaking to a lot of Brazilian teams. I had quite a lot of offers, but never a work permit. And after that, you know, previous experience, I said I won't go anywhere until I've got a work permit.
That's fair.
Went back and played for Stamford, more in the first team now. But then I broke my leg at Loughborough. And after that, I thought, well, this is probably the end of professional dream. I'll just go and play like non-league or play futsal and just enjoy it a bit more. And by the time the next opportunity came around, I was 28. So yeah, 10 years after the Brazil opportunity. And someone tweeted, they said, Seth, do you know anyone who'd be interested in playing football in Sri Lanka? It would suit a, you know, good first team university player, just expenses paid. And I said, well, I'll ask. And I spoke to some people and I messaged Loughborough and said, you know, is anyone fancy this? And no one did. So I replied to the guy saying, well, I quite fancy it. And that's the benefit of having a book out about playing in Brazil, is people know you're willing to play football abroad.
Sure.
Didn't really think much of it after that. And then there were the Easter bombings and been out of my mind a bit by then, that I'd said, yeah, I'll quite fancy going to Sri Lanka. Mm. A few weeks after that, I just got a random phone call from a number I didn't recognise. And that's it. It was a guy called Tabit. And he said, oh, Seth, I hear you're interested in going to Sri Lanka. I was like, well, yeah, I'd be interested. He said, great, you're my first signing.
There you go.
I said, well, don't you want to like, seeing a planet, because at that stage I hadn't actually been playing football. I hadn't played football for 2-3 years. I'd just been playing futsal. And I said, you know, don't you want to see me play or like any clips or anything? So I can sort that out. He said, oh, no, I've read your book, so I'm sure you're fine. Said, oh, great. He said, just one question though. How tall are you? And I said, I'm about 5'11". He said, great, that's all I need to know. Yep, you're my first signing. Here's a have a contract. I want to build my team around you.
Nice.
So I was still a bit unsure at this point. So my girlfriend was sitting next to me on the sofa, and I hadn't really told her that I'd said yes about playing in Sri Lanka. And I wasn't sure how she's going to take it. But then he said to me, Seth, you know that this team, by the way, it's going to be owned by Mahela Jayawardene and Kumar Sangakkara. And I'm quite into my cricket. And growing up, I used to love watching Sri Lanka play cricket, and those two especially. That was definitely a pull factor on me saying, well, I'd love to do this now. So I put the phone down, kind of verbally agreed it, and said to my girlfriend, how would you feel about me going to Sri Lanka? And she probably couldn't get me out of the door quick enough, to be fair. She was going a little break from me.
Again, not quite the same as Brazil in terms of the system, but this was, rather than a whole quote-unquote season, this would have been for a side in the Northeastern Premier League, which they will get into the breakdown of geography.
Essentially, it's not a league, it's a Super League.
Yeah, it's a franchise Super League where you have a draft system and everything, so it is a Super League, really. I mean, it's such a complex culture out in Sri Lanka. But this league had been set up by the Tamil Football Federation, and it was to promote players in the northeast, but it's also to rebuild the area after the war. And I mean, before going to Sri Lanka, I knew there had been a war, but I didn't know much about that war. I didn't know what a Sinhalese person was. I kind of knew the Tamils because of the Tamil Tigers, but didn't know much about that. But going to Sri Lanka really opened my eyes to it. And this area of the Northeast had been badly affected by this war, which I think lasted for 34 years, the Civil War. Right. And they were trying to use sport to regenerate the area and to promote Sinhalese-Tamil relations. And as part of that, this tournament, it was each team was allowed 4 foreign professionals. And until that point, they'd all come from Nigeria and Ghana, those foreign professionals. But this coach had links with people in the UK, and he wanted to bring some Europeans over as the professionals this season.
Because officially, despite all that, it's officially like the third tier or something, wasn't it?
It's not really in the system, and that's why it's kind of had some problems down the line. Because The Sri Lankan Football Association isn't exclusively run by Sinhalese. It is mixed with Tamils and Muslims as well, which are the three main cultures there. But it's predominantly Sinhalese, whereas the Tamil Football Federation is obviously predominantly Tamil. And so you do have a political kind of concern there, especially because the prize money in the Tamil Football Federation tournament is quite a lot. And players can earn more by playing in the Tamil Football Federation than they can in the Sri Lankan League.
Yeah.
So it was quite a strange setup, especially because if you weren't in the Northeast, you're classed as foreign professional. So there were a few national team players for Sri Lanka, but really it was supposed to be like a 2-month-long tournament, which was played around the Sri Lankan Champions League. But in reality, it turned out to be, well, I think, almost 4 months I was there for in the end.
And you mentioned in the book, there's a big delay, and that really put it in peril, your likeliness of, you know, I might not be able to even stay for the season starting because it hasn't worked out that way. The two foreign nationals in your side, Trinco Titans, were yourself and a guy from Ireland.
Dean.
And I feel like you were able to kind of reluctantly push some stuff aside to stay. It was a bit harder for him, right?
Yeah, I think also the fact that I'd been in Brazil before and experienced it before, whereas Dean was younger than me. And for him, this was all totally new. And I mean, having him alongside me for Sri Lanka just helped so much. He was a great guy. Got on really well with him. And also it gives you someone to complain to. But also the thing that helped was it was really tough on the pitch because it was, you know, we had hard training sessions at first. There was a lot of just strange stuff going on. But in terms of how we were looked after in Sri Lanka, it was brilliant. You know, we had a great house. We were just on the beach. Absolutely beautiful place. So that also helped encourage me to stay on and to, you know, see it out.
So it does start, and as you say, you've mentioned that it's designed to promote the area and the unity, and there's big name investors kind of overseeing it all, big pot. But there are patches of it where that investment hasn't necessarily been realised. So, for example, the pitch quality and stuff like that. So what was the worst pitch you played on?
I mean, there wasn't any good pitch that I played on, really. Our home pitch was just terrible. It was, to give you an example of what it was, before the games had to water it, not to make the ball roll better, but because if they didn't water it, it would get so dusty that the spectators couldn't see where the ball was, really.
Wow.
So our home pitch, it was a mix of sand, dust, stone, really sharp gravel-like stone. In the middle of the pitch, there was a raised cricket wicket. So it was kind of pushed into the surface and it went up a bit. So you kind of always had to watch where that was because quite a few people tripped over it. There were bricks hammered into the surface for some reason, which again, you had to watch. Stones everywhere, so you couldn't really slide tackle. The lines were painted on with tar, so you didn't really want to touch them either. Yeah. And there was just so much like animal poo as well all over the pitch because the cows get let out onto the pitch. Right. And so before every game, we'd have to go around with a shovel to try and shovel that poo off, try and get rid of the sharpest stones. But I mean, there were games where I'd forget and I'd slide tackle and I'd have to go off the pitch to be bandaged up because I was bleeding so much after that.
God.
I was going to ask, sorry, about how many divots there are on the pitch. I mean, cow hooves are pretty heavy and, you know, like, if they're walking over it quite regularly, like, how did you pass along the floor?
The best way to play in Sri Lanka, because the ground's so hard and because the ball bobbles so much. I mean, in one pitch, there are snake holes in it. Jeez. Because the ball, the goalkeeper should boot it as high up in the air as possible. And because the game's quite stretched in Sri Lanka, because the officials tend to favour the home team, they get quite intimidated by the crowd. And I mean, I'd get quite intimidated by the crowd because there's quite a lot of violence that's happened at football games in Sri Lanka. And so they don't tend to give offsides, which means that the game is really stretched and you've got massive gaps between midfield and defence, midfield and up front. And so if you kick the ball really high into the air, there's a good chance it will bounce on the surface and just go anywhere. So that was very much our team really played like a very basic route one game of get it forward as quick as possible, because if it's in their half, we probably can't make a mistake to concede. Yeah. And there were a couple of teams actually who popped the ball around really nicely and did look very good and did it well. But I think you have to be quite high level technically to be able to do that on a pitch like that.
And how high level technically were your side, the Trinco Titans? How did you feel you matched in terms of level with those guys generally?
I mean, without being big-headed, I do feel that me and Dean were the best players there. I felt that there was a clear distinction between the foreign professionals in each team and the locally based players. Not saying that they were terrible, because there were actually quite a few locally based players who were handy players. Mm. The problem you have over there is that tactically it's such a basic level. You used to just really driving around the bend where I had to play centre back, and I'd have my full back would be literally touch tight to the winger, even if the winger was right over the other side. So there's always massive gaps in the team. So that was the main problem, because actually if they would have had a tactical coaching and kind of been brought up having been coached, the standard would have been decent. It would have probably been similar to semi-pro level in England. But without a tactical knowledge, it was quite basic, I'd say, the standard. But that's just a problem with the country itself, and where the only coaching really is in the capital, Colombo. And outside of that, you've just got guys saying, go play football, and trying to copy what they see on the telly.
And I guess that's reflected in their national team as well, because the only real mention of Sri Lankan national team in the last few years was when they got beaten by Bhutan, I think, who were like at the time the worst ranked team in FIFA, and they beat Sri Lanka over two legs. So like, that gives you an idea of what they're dealing with. So yeah, I guess that you're describing all the symptoms that lead to the appalling standard. Yeah.
Yeah, and to be honest, I went and saw the Sri Lankan team play against Uzbekistan towards the end of my stay there. And you think about teams who are, I think they're ranked 206th in the world, and you see a team ranked that low and you think they're going to be terrible. But they weren't bad, to be honest. They weren't bad. And I think if you do get that coaching infrastructure in place, then Sri Lanka can go quite a lot up the rankings. I mean, probably not top 100, but the main problem there is coaching infrastructure. And I hope that will come over time, especially with tournaments like the North East Premier League and bringing in players from abroad to share kind of their learnings. And a lot of the players were quite receptive to that. They actively sought out mine and Dean's advice, and they would take it on board quite quickly. So there is definitely potential there, but it's at a frustrating point at the moment, I'd say.
Would you say, if in any way, Sri Lankan football shaped you as a player?
I think the importance of like communication, whereas in Brazil, I was very much trying to fit in, as in Sri Lanka, I was brought in as a leader. And it's really strange as well to kind of always be at the centre of a game, because whenever we went to play an away game, the fans were just amazed that there were white guys playing. And that meant that we were at the attention of the fans trying to put us off, but also we had quite a lot of bad tackles our way. So I think dealing with that and trying to organise my team as well, and just the power of communication there helps a lot. I think similar to Brazil as well, seeing their situation, how I dealt with that. I mean, we were playing against guys who had fought for the Tamil Tigers. One of our opponents, he'd had his arm blown off in a bomb blast. He was a former sports instructor of the Tamil Tigers. My teammates, I'd say well over half of them had family members killed in the war. Right. Probably all of them knew someone who'd been killed in the war. And I think how he'd overcome that, and how, despite seeing so much death all around them and so much, you know, bad, horrible stuff happening in their lives, they just got on with it and they were so friendly and welcoming. That also taught me a lot. So again, I think I learned a lot about life in Sri Lanka. Patience as well. Patience with having to kind of wait on and off this tournament to actually get started, and for all this poor organisation to kind of start a tournament. That was a big learning.
As you mentioned, before you went out there, there were these blasts in Colombo, I believe. And while the kind of worst of it has been over, there's still flashpoints and the conflict is always slightly bubbling over there. While you were there, did you feel experience yourself, especially as I imagine towards the northeast, as you're going away from the tourist spots, you may be sticking out a little bit. What was your encounters with, you know, the authorities or rebel groups or just the local tensions? How was that?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm glad that I only found all this stuff out when I was out there, because if I'd known it before I went out there, I wouldn't have gone to Sri Lanka, because the tensions are still there. I think especially right now, where they've elected a guy as president who's essentially like a nationalist, kind of in the mould of Trump. And I only really saw kind of what Tamils and people in the northeast were up against when I went to Colombo just to fly back home for a week for my mate's wedding. And police officer stopped the car and he made us all get out. And he said, "Oh, are you Tamil?" And the guy said, "Yes." And after that, like, he just totally changed and he started treating them really badly. And I think that's the problem there. It's quite scary in that Sri Lanka, you've got this whole You know, you've got Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. You've got lots of religions, lots of different, you know, you've got Sinhalese, Muslim, and Tamil. And they're kind of like all in this country, but you've got a lot of people in the country now who think that it's a Buddhist-only country. And they think that because they've won the war, the Sinhalese did, that they that gives them kind of the right to do what they want and put just Buddhist flags in places. And I only really experienced that once with the authorities. They're just, yeah, a couple of things that go on in the country make me uneasy. I do fear in parts for the mates that I made in the Northeast because, I mean, there's always a danger in every country that anger will spill over into real violence. Mm. And it has done in Sri Lanka. There are examples of all sorts of horrible things happening. Yeah, I hope that they can overcome those problems and I hope that they can use sport to overcome those problems because as much as that negative stuff is happening, there's also amazing positives. Like in our team, we had a big mix of Tamils, Sinhalese, Muslims, and we all got on great and the project was funded by a mix of these people. And the vast majority of these people get on well and they're willing to put the war behind them and move on in a unified country. But it's always the 1% you worry about and how much impact they'll have.
I mean, there's lots of questions I still want to ask you, of course. But staying out there, why did you agree to stay while you're having these kind of thoughts where you kind of question the country? Like, what is it about it that made you think, I need to remain here and play a little bit more football?
You always read stuff in the papers about how terrible the situation is. But the people that I came into contact with were just absolutely incredible. I mean, these guys are earning less than £5 a day. They're not in extreme poverty. None of my teammates really were, but they'd all be classed as poverty, I'd say. And yet, despite having so little, like we'd go to a restaurant and they'd say, "Seth, we have to pay for you." And I'd say, "No, you can't do that." But this was the kind of guys they were. They all wanted to host me at their house and cook for me and Dean. Mm. And they're just so friendly and couldn't do enough for me that you kind of have that. You're surrounded by that and you don't really want to leave. And it is a beautiful place. And you kind of feel like you want to give back to them after they've treated you so, so well. I mean, absolutely everyone that was part of the Tringo Titans, from the coaching staff to the players, were just absolutely great to us. And they made you feel like you were involved and you were part of something bigger. And so that was definitely the main reason for wanting to stay. And I mean, to be honest, I'd have gone back as well if it wasn't for COVID potentially. So yeah, those people were great. And I still speak to some of them pretty much daily, I'd say, over WhatsApp.
Some of the places you describe in Titans of the Teardrop Isle, which is, covers this whole time in Sri Lanka, it sounds like a paradise visually and stuff, as well as how the people are. Obviously, we'll get to maybe the experiences in the stadiums might have been a bit different, but the actual day-to-day living and you seem quite content with that life. You could have happily been there a lot longer.
Yeah, it was actually good. So when I mentioned like going back to England for a week for my mate's wedding, I kind of, because before then I'd been quite frustrated about not being able to get on the training pitch. We had about 3 weeks where we only trained on the beach and that was every other day. And so I found that quite hard. And when I came back to England, I thought, you know what, I'm in a beautiful place here, Sri Lanka, I need to make the most of it. And so then when I flew back to Sri Lanka, and this was still before the tournament started, I said to myself, right, you know, I'm going to go to the beach every day. I'm going to swim in the ocean. And that changed a lot for me. And I did start to see it as paradise and just started to enjoy my surroundings a bit more and almost focusing less on the football and just using football as a vehicle to travel, I think was a big part of seeing that as a positive.
You mentioned before you went out to Sri Lanka, you had a girlfriend. How did she feel about you going to Sri Lanka first and then extending by twice the amount of time that you said you would?
It worked out all right because she works in advertising and she had a big pitch going on. So I think we've always been like quite independent with each other. So we met at university, then I had an extra year while she was down in London. And so being apart from each other was fine. I think she always knew that, you know, she knew that I'd always come back. I think she probably would rather I didn't go out again to another random country, but we'll see what happens. I mean, we're engaged now, so I actually got engaged to her in Sri Lanka, so.
There you go. All worth it then, sir.
Exactly. Hey.
The books. So you've written a book about the Brazilian experience and your Sri Lankan one. So at what point, I imagine, so when you're in Brazil, from the very start, are you kind of chronicling, are you writing, are you putting a diary down and going, I think this would make a great book, writing all this down?
I hadn't gone out there thinking I'll write this as a book. But because we had a lot of downtime and because I didn't speak the language and there's only so many times you can stand up in the middle of the room and say a swear word in Portuguese. So to pass the time, I just kept a diary and I kept it quite thoroughly because I had so much time on my hands. And it was only towards the end where things started getting a bit crazier that I thought, yeah, I'm going to write this up into a book. I mean, the levels of craziness it got is that one of our directors got murdered and there's strong rumours that was a hit job. So after stuff like that, I thought I have to write this up as a book. Whereas Sri Lanka, it was different. By then, I'd written 6 or 7 books. And actually, I thought if I do go to Sri Lanka, I can write another book here. So it was almost incentive to go.
And I suppose you more than well practiced then, so you knew, here's how I need to chronicle this in Sri Lanka. You weren't kind of doing it on the fly as you were might have been in Brazil, trying to retcon it into a book.
Yeah, there's a couple of times where, like, because I made it open that I'm going to write this into a book, and there's a couple of times where Dean would say to me, oh, you can't write this stuff. And it's like, oh, well, no, actually, you are writing this stuff. So I mean, I went there not knowing much about Sri Lanka, so I thought, I'll write this as a book, but it might not be that interesting. But to me, the more I learned about the country, I think it's just such an interesting country. I've read like 20, 30 books about Sri Lanka after coming back from the place, and I still can't get my head around it, to be honest. And that's what I found quite hard with writing Titans of the Teardrop Isle, is that because it's such a complex country, I really didn't want to offend anyone. But I think there's always going to be something that offends people in the book. But it did mean that it had to go through quite a lot of like checks after writing it, and to make sure that it was all absolutely correct. Because these are quite big allegations, I think, you're throwing. Because the trouble is that, you know, the winners always rewrite history, and what the Sri Lankan government did at the time was really bad. And we've had lots of documentaries over in the UK about that. But in Sri Lanka, that's kind of been whitewashed, and you've only got their method of what happens. So it was quite challenging to write about.
But no, seriously, Titans of the Teardrop Isle, it's a great book. I'm not just saying that, obviously, because you're on the show, but a nice mix of anecdotal stuff that happened to you, combined with what you had learned and research you'd learned about the place. And I think a lot of people enjoy it.
It speaks to everything about why we started this podcast. You know, you can see, if anyone that's listening that likes this podcast for the reasons that we do it, we insist that you will go out and check both books. So Seth, congratulations on those releases. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, man, if you ever get a chance to go play in, like, you know, like a very random country that you...
Vanuatu, that's our level. We're not... I didn't play at semi-pro level. I don't know about Scully, but just a little bit lower down, I'll happily play a friendly. Even if it's just a friendly, we'll go out and...
Any team that will have me.
I'll put in words.
Hearing that story, it really does light a fire in you to think, what could we do? Like, if we put our hearts and minds to it, if we had the time and the window of opportunity to do so, could we do 3 months playing in professionally somewhere? Is there like a professional league in American Samoa that needs us real bad? The answer is probably no. But yeah, I wonder how far down the FIFA World Rankings can you go before there's like professional leagues or professional football stops? Because, you know, at the very bottom, you'll have San Marinos and everything. They might have a domestic league, but it might be part-time. How far do you have to go down where it's still professional, but we would be good enough to play? Maybe money isn't even a factor, but it just got the imagination going.
I would do it for the story, for the plot, as the kids say. Like, why not? And yeah, you know, you're not necessarily going to make an impact. I'm not expected to go on a crazy cup run, but like, it would be great to like just inspire some people. Big upset.
Since that interview, there's been another fresh print run of The Boy in Brazil, and Titans of the Teardrop Isle, the Sri Lankan book, is still everywhere. You know, it's not going to be too difficult to find. They're both worthwhile reads. We've both read them, although I'd like to read Titans of the Teardrop Isle again, if you've still got it there somewhere.
I definitely do still have it.
The fact you don't know means it's probably long.
Oh, no, I've definitely still got it. I forgot that I needed to give it back. I thought you bought 10 copies.
Amazing interview, and we implore you to check out Seth's further work and his books. We'll post links to them on our feeds as well, so you know where to go. What are those social media feeds and accounts, Scully?
You can find us everywhere on INTL Clearance. That's TikTok, Instagram and Twitter, or X, whatever you want to call it now. And if you want to reach out to us, which a few of you actually do, you can use our email, intlclearance@gmail.com.
Yeah, the emails have become like tip-off central. People just going, have a look at this person, or see if you can get hold of this person. It's proving very fruitful. So thank you very much.
We welcome the recommendations, by the way.
Absolutely. Love it.
If there's any more interesting stories like Seth's to share, please send them our way.
Because it's the point of us doing this podcast was that it was a niche, but it's not so small a niche that we know every single person that fits the remit. Do you know what I mean? There's stories out there to discover, and we're all ears. And that concludes quite a big episode 15 of International Clearance. And we'll wrap it up there. I've been Joe Walker.
And I've been Scully.
And we'll see you next week.